on the film now. Kaleem, what's your final thoughts on this documentary, and would you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it, but I would recommend it for kind of the romanticism and poeticness of it, and that is very different to other documentaries on this subject for its uniqueness rather than perhaps its political message.
And Jonathan, your final thoughts on
this? Well, I would agree with that. I think it's a sort of good introduction to get in there. It points to some complex issues in a simplistic way, but it's because it's so romantically filmed and brilliantly filmed, it should get people more interested to learn more.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests again. And for you, I've been Camilla Shambriati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, Ramadan has come again and we have been invited to fast in this blessed month. One of the most important religious teachings which will lead to God's satisfaction is the fasting of the blessed month of Ramadan. God has ordered people in this month to abstain from eating, drinking, and a few other pleasures which are permissible in other months. Of course, this prohibition is limited to specific hours of day. It starts from the dawn till the dusk. In other words, it includes the time span between the azan of Fajr, or call for the dawn prayer, and the azan of Maghrib, that is call for evening prayer. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "The month of Ramadan is accompanied by mercy, blessing, and forgiveness. Your sleep in it is worship, and your breath are glorification of God. Therefore, although fasting is abstention from certain pleasures for specific hours, in fact, human beings will enjoy foods and drinks of paradise as a result of this abstention." A fasting person indeed obeying God and observing the conditions of servitude to God by tolerating hunger and thirst and refraining from pleasures that are permitted in other months. As a matter of fact, when the main goal and concern of the individual is to meet his worldly needs and attain short-lived pleasures of this world, he will fail to heed the lofty goal of creation and understand the divine truth. The blessed month of Ramadan is an opportunity for exercise to get rid of the worldly attachments with the aim of achieving freedom and spirituality. In fact, fasting for 1 month is an exercise to relieve the heart from the chains and shackles of carnal desires. This period can make the spirit purified to attain the divine proximity. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "He who fasts in the month of Ramadan and prevents his eyes, ears, and bodily organs from haram, lying, and backbiting, with the aim of God's proximity, God will take him closer to himself." In Islam, fasting means to abstain from eating, drinking, and a few other acts. A fasting person is obligated to refrain from a few deeds from dawn to dusk. Fasting has been mentioned in a few ayahs of the Noble Quran. Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah is the ayah which explicitly says that fasting is obligatory for the faithful. It reads, "O you who have faith, fasting has been prescribed for you just like it was prescribed for those before you, so that you may be God-weary." Ayah 183 of Surah Baqarah refers to two important points. The first point is that fasting had been obligatory for other people before Islam too. According to the historical accounts, followers of other religions like Jews and Christians used to fast to seek God's forgiveness. The second point is the fact that fasting leads to God-weariness. The great exegete of the Noble Quran in the 20th century, Allama Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai, said in this regard, "According to this ayah, the benefit of fasting is God-weariness. Anyone who wants to be connected to the world of purity and exaltation, to reach the lofty status of perfection and spirituality, the first thing that he has to abide by is to prevent his being unbridled, so that he is not engaged in physical and carnal pleasures unconditionally, so that he considers himself greater than thinking of the material world as the goal, and that avoids from anything that makes him neglect God. The God-weariness that the Quran refers to is achieved only through fasting and abstention from carnal desires." Dear listeners, in Ayah 185 of Surah Baqarah 2, God refers to the month of Ramadan at the revelation of the Quran, saying, "The month of Ramadan is the one in which the Quran was sent down as guidance to mankind, with manifest proofs of guidance and the criterion. The best hours for recitation of the Noble Quran and getting close to this heavenly book are the days of the month of Ramadan. The Quran is a reality that was revealed to the Prophet of Islam in its perfect form, but we can benefit from this divine mercy through reciting it and putting it into practice as much as we can." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Indeed, hearts get rusted and polluted by sins like the iron that rusts. And what polishes them and removes pollutions is recitation of the Noble Quran." Dear friends, praying and supplication purify our hearts and make us closer to the divine mercy. So, in the end of this episode, we raise our hands and pray to God with a supplication from Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the sixth infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam. My God, this is a blessed month in which the Quran was sent down. The Quran, which is the guidance for mankind and the criterion. My God, open for me a path toward every good deed and prevent me from any deed that you do not like. My God, you admonished me, but I wasn't admonished. So, how can I apologize at your court? My God, I ask your forgiveness and pardoning and the comfort at the time of death. O you who are famous for forgiveness and pardoning, I am your servant and son of your servant. I am unable and in need of your mercy, and you are the only one who send blessing and richness to your servants. You have distributed the sustenance of your servants and made their languages and colors different. And we all need your mercy. So do not turn your face from us. My God, make my life the best life and my death the best death. Make my sustenance friendship with your friends and enmity with your enemies. Enthusiasm for your court along with humbleness and submission to you. And distance, doubt, repudiation and despair from me. My God, send your greetings to Muhammad and his progeny, the perpetual greeting that no one will be able to count it except you. O the most merciful of the merciful.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan.
During Ramadan, we should establish a spiritual relationship with ourselves and others. The environment of Ramadan is the environment of warmth, spirituality, honesty, and purity. We should try to make the most of this environment. Both for the sake of our spiritual relationship with God, we should strengthen the spiritual and personal relationship with Allah the Exalted, because the best and the greatest advantage for anyone is strengthening this relationship. And for the sake of our eternal life in the hereafter, because the real life exists in the hereafter. Making the most of this environment is beneficial for both hereafter and for our life in this world. Besides, we should try to benefit from this spiritual and pure environment, which exists in the month of Ramadan on a public level, for establishing a proper and spiritual relationship between ourselves and other people, for making correct decisions and for adopting proper measures in our relationships with other people. We should be optimistic, we should have trust in others, we should be kind and well-wishing.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان دوما قريب
Providing the people with a simple iftar is a very appropriate act. It is good to pay attention to this issue, which is the act of providing the people with simple and unadorned iftar meals in our mosques and on the streets of many cities of the country. Unlike the act of offering extravagant iftar meals, which we heard a number of people did, this is a very appropriate act. Under the pretext of offering iftar meals, these people engaged in extravagant acts. Instead of becoming an instrument for establishing a psychological relationship with the poor and the deprived in the month of Ramadan, they indulged themselves in carnal desires by doing this. We do not want to say that if somebody eats a delicious food during iftar, this is forbidden. No, according to Sharia, these things are not forbidden. But extravagance and overindulgence are forbidden. The extravagance which is sometimes witnessed in such occasions is forbidden. It is so much better for those who want to offer iftar meals to do this by cherishing the tradition which has become common.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The European Commission has said it is seeking urgent clarification from Johnson & Johnson after the company's completely unexpected announcement that it is delaying the deployment of its coronavirus vaccine across Europe, following concerns in the United States about a small number of blood clots. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley, with contribution from the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, EU Seeking Urgent Clarification on Johnson & Johnson COVID Vaccine Delay. Stay with us for more. The European Commission has said it is seeking urgent clarification from Johnson & Johnson after the company's completely unexpected announcement that it is delaying the deployment of its coronavirus vaccine across Europe, following concerns in the United States about a small number of blood clots. After US health agencies recommended states temporarily halt use of the shot on Tuesday, 13th of April, Johnson & Johnson said in a statement, it had been reviewing these cases with European health authorities and had made the decision to proactively delay the rollout of our vaccine in Europe. A European Commission official told the Reuters news agency the company had confirmed at a meeting on Friday it aimed to deliver 55 million doses of the vaccine to the European Union, as contracted, by the end of June. The official said the European Commission was in contact with the company to get clarification. The European Union's drug regulator, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, which approved the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine last month, confirmed on Tuesday, 13th of April, that it was reviewing four cases of rare blood clots in women who had taken the vaccine shot. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, added in a statement to the Reuters news agency that it was currently not clear whether there is a causal association between vaccination and the conditions. The European Medicines Agency will further communicate once the evaluation has concluded, it said. Johnson & Johnson has committed to delivering at least 200 million doses of the vaccine to the European bloc this year. The United Kingdom has not so far approved the vaccine for use in Britain, but has 30 million doses on order. This is worrying news. Sounds like it may end up the same way as AstraZeneca, a European Union diplomat said. The clotting concerns mirror those of drug agencies in Europe and Australia over the AstraZeneca vaccine, whose use has been restricted in several countries to people over the ages of 55, 60 or 65. AstraZeneca also cut vaccine supplies to the European bloc to 100 million doses by the end of June, from the original 300 million foreseen under its original supply contract, triggering a dispute with the European Union that remains unresolved. The European Commissioner in charge of the EU's vaccination programme, Thierry Breton, said last week the bloc was due to receive 200 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine in the next 3 months, along with 35 million doses of the vaccine from Moderna, 70 million doses of the vaccine from AstraZeneca, and 55 million doses of the vaccine from Johnson & Johnson, and 10 million doses of the vaccine from CureVac. The US Center for Disease Control, CDC, and the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, earlier recommended a pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine while investigations take place into six cases involving women who have experienced rare blood clotting events combined with low platelets in the days following vaccination. More than 6.8 million doses of the vaccine have been administered in the United States. Several European countries, including France, Spain and the Netherlands, were taking delivery of their first batches of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine shot this week. The Dutch Health Minister, Hugo de Jong, said he was not sure whether the country would now do so. "I cannot say at this moment. It depends on the messaging we get tomorrow. I expect tomorrow from the European Medicine Agency, EMA," Hugo de Jong said. South Africa temporarily suspended the rollout of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine shot on Tuesday. South Africa's Health Minister Zweli Mkhize said the country cannot take the decision by the FDA lightly. "Based on their advice, we have determined to voluntarily suspend our rollout until the causal relationship is sufficiently interrogated." Meanwhile, U.S. health agencies have recommended states pause the administration of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine after reports of rare and severe blood clots emerged in six women. The concerns mirror those of drug agencies in Europe and Australia over the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has not been authorized in the United States. There have been no significant safety concerns raised about the two other vaccines that make up the majority of U.S. supplies, from Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna. The acting FDA chief, Janet Woodstock, said, "We're recommending this pause while we work together to fully understand these events." The decision was taken in coordination with the Center for Disease Control, CDC. The head of the FDA, Janet Woodstock, said, "Right now, I like to stress these events appear to be extremely rare. However, COVID-19 vaccine safety is a top priority for the federal government. We take all reports of adverse events related to the vaccine very seriously." The Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and the Center for Disease Control, CDC, said in a joint statement, "People who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine who develop severe headache, abdominal pain, leg pain, or shortness of breath within 3 weeks after vaccination should immediately contact their healthcare provider."
Debate. September 11, the date the U.S. was hit with a terrorist act. It invaded and occupied Afghanistan shortly after that. And it will be the same date that it will withdraw its forces from that country. What does the U.S. have to show for it after almost 20 years of war and occupation? Well, not much, considering that the group it wanted to eliminate won't even attend talks with it, settling only for its ouster. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the subject of this edition of the debate.
The phrase of September 11 revives the memory of terrorist attacks in the U.S. that later in October 2001 brought the U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan in the name of International Security Assistance Forces, ISAF. Earlier, in a joint press conference with NATO chief, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antonio Blinken, said that the two sides would work together on a safe, deliberate and coordinated withdrawal of their forces from Afghanistan. Officials in Kabul also say the decision would be later discussed by the presidents of Afghanistan and the U.S.
The Afghan government respects the U.S. decision and the presidents of both countries are going to discuss the issue again. Afghanistan's security and defense forces are capable of protecting the country. They have done so in the past and will do so in the future.
This comes as the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan was agreed between the Taliban and the U.S. during negotiations in the Qatari capital Doha last year. With such change on Washington's policy, the Taliban has also declared that it's not willing to attend Turkey summit until foreign troops are stationed in Afghanistan. Government officials here believe the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is not the main cause behind Taliban's decision not to attend Turkey summit, but it's a pretext for the militants to further wage the war in the country.
Taliban has wasted time over the past year by fueling the flames of war instead of trying to bring peace. The presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is a pretext for the Taliban to continue their illegal war against our people.
As the Taliban has become a serious headache for the U.S. despite 20 years of fighting, many here argue that there would be no win for no one via military ways. Therefore, they want Taliban and other players to set aside their differences and reach a comprehensive agreement in order to lead this wounded part of the world to peace and stability. However, the issue of withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan is not the only matter of concern for the Taliban, as there are some other key factors that affect groups looked toward Turkey summit, including the fate of political system in Afghanistan. Some observers worry that with foreign troops gone, Afghanistan will witness a rise in violence, but that can't be farther than the truth, as Afghan forces are well equipped to fight any security threat rapidly and effectively. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
For guests joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. We also have Syed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me first start with you. Almost no sooner did the U.S. President Joe Biden begin his speech today, which is ongoing as we speak, did the words come out of his mouth that said, our reasons for staying in Afghanistan have become increasingly unclear. After 20 years for the U.S. President to say that, it speaks volumes. What is your impression of what he has said there?
Well, there's very little honesty that comes from the U.S. government on foreign policy issues, and this is another example of not facing up to the reality of what has really been the role of the United States in Afghanistan. The common saying is that it's the longest war, or second longest war in U.S. history, and it started in 2001, but really the war against Afghanistan started in 1979 and was later confessed to by U.S. leaders after they were out of office. So really we've seen more than four decades of U.S. intervention which has wreaked havoc on the country. First it was to overthrow a progressive government that attempted in the late 70s and 1980s to implement changes that would improve the lot of people who were still living in a semi-feudal society in most of Afghanistan. And we see in 2001, after the U.S. had been out of Afghanistan for a period of years, go back in on the pretext that this was, as revenge, and it really was for revenge, but the pretext that this was somehow to help people, help women, that was a theme that was played. All U.S. intervention has done in Afghanistan is wreak destruction on the country and the people of Afghanistan at an enormous cost in human lives, and treasure.
Say, Mohsen Abbas, I mean, really, if you really want to look at what has happened there, I mean, you know, 20 years of the U.S. being there, along with some of the other NATO member countries, at one point, I believe, the highest number came in at around 100,000 troops, maybe a little bit more. And yet, you're dealing with 5,000, 6,000 Taliban. I mean, why did the U.S. and its NATO partners, countries, not be able to defeat the Taliban?
I think it's a sort of a false kind of strategic analysis on the part of the American establishment that they could ever achieve victory. That's the best I can say for them. The other is to say that cynically they knew perfectly well that they wouldn't be able to do this. In fact, they just needed to be there for their own geopolitical and resource rate agendas. You know, there is far more wealth in Afghanistan, there was than people realize. There's far more also strategic importance given the, for instance, the Russian presence, the Chinese Belt Road Initiative, Pakistan and India, you know, so huge interests, not least of all to mention that the Islamic Republic of Iran, who the Americans have been after, is next door as well. So Afghanistan was vital, not for the reasons they were saying, which was to hunt down terrorists, but rather for the purpose of advancing their own greed and their own hegemony in the region. Now, the net result you talked about, after 20 years of what I call occupation of Afghanistan, and that despite the fact they declare victory, laughably, along the way as well, they've used torture, they've done the rendition exercises on individuals, 15,000-pound bombs, drone strikes, and tens of thousands of troops, as you've mentioned, have been involved. But today, that is still the Taliban that control the vast majority of Afghanistan and who are present in most of the country. Of course, what other results? Well, we can see that Al-Qaeda, which was only based in remote parts of Afghanistan when they said they would go in at best, and even there we know that the Al-Qaeda link is very strongly connected to American deep state itself. Whilst it was supposed to be in remote parts of Afghanistan before, it's sprouted globally, you know, with franchises in Iraq, which we all know very well, you know, the ISIS AQI fraternity, in Yemen, in North Africa, the Levant, and beyond. So Al-Qaeda eventually transformed into ISIS that we know in Camp Buka at Abu Ghraib after its leaders met with former members of Saddam's regime. That was another gift from the American war of terror that they inflicted on Afghanistan, which had reverberations everywhere. Of course, hundreds of thousands killed, maimed, or displaced by both invasions that they carried out as well. I mean, I could go on, but I think that's kind of gives people an idea of the huge global terrorism which has increased because of the so-called American intervention to stop terrorism. You know, it's been an absolute disaster.
Yeah, Richard Becker, just a few years back, based on a 2,000 pages of previously, at that point, unpublished notes of interviews with the generals and people who played a direct role in the war, and diplomats to be included in there, and aid workers, you name Afghan officials, part of this really vast investigation. The findings that came out were shocking. One of them, U.S. officials constantly had said that they were making progress in Afghanistan, but they failed to tell the truth about the war throughout the campaign, making rosy pronouncements that they knew were false and hiding unmistakable evidence that the war had become unwinnable. Now, this is going back a few years when the findings came out, referring back to the years before that. If that was the case, then what reasons did the U.S. have to continue for what this is stated, one of the findings, that it was an unwinnable war?
Well, there's actually nothing new about this. I mean, that's what the Pentagon Papers were all about back at the time of the Vietnam War, after the war had gone on and huge casualties had already taken place and massive destruction of Vietnam. And then the Pentagon Papers came out and the government tried to put on trial Daniel Ellsberg, the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, who had worked for RAND Corporation. And what his crime was he exposed the reality of that war, and that after years of the public, the American public being told, oh, we're winning, and just, you know, another 50,000 troops, and it'll be all over. I remember that when I was young. And it was, they knew from 1965 that they couldn't really win they couldn't win the war, but that had to be kept secret from the people. And the same thing has happened also with Chelsea Manning and those who work with Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, who revealed the reality, the crime. If there was honesty in the system, they would charge them with the crime of exposing U.S. war crimes. So the military always wants to go on until they, you know, they get to a certain point and they know that it's impossible. But as your other guest said, Afghanistan has tremendous strategic importance. It's you know, surrounded by several other states, and states that are in contention with the United States right now. And the idea that, not that the Taliban, I don't believe, has sympathy with Russia or China or any of that, but the fact that Afghanistan could slip out of the grasp of the United States, the strategic grasp of the United States, that's what really kept them in the war for all this time, when knowing that they weren't going to be able to win. And I would say, add one thing to this, is that for years and years, they had known this. And still, they kept setting U.S. troops, and just to show the cynicism of the Pentagon and the war makers, they kept sending U.S. troops and other NATO troops out into forward operating bases, FOBs as they were called, really not for any other reason except to draw fire of the Taliban forces, of the anti-occupation forces, and then the U.S. could use air power to try to obliterate those forces. I mean, that's what people were doing out in the forward operating bases year after year after year, when the military high command knew they couldn't win the war.
Yeah, and taxpayer money there. Not to mention the exorbitant amount of money that was spent on a variety of issues in that country, like rebuilding, which never panned out the way that they wanted to. Now, Simhasan Abbas, you know, we could talk about how the U.S. has failed, but some of these fine details that came out on this investigation that I referred to are really mind-boggling. And I'm going to quote you what one of the three-star Army generals who served as the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administration. He said, quote, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing there." In addition, he said, "What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." What does that say about the U.S. and the way that its army is run?
Well, it says that there's absolutely no common sense and no analysis or genuine purpose for spreading what they often use as an excuse for going in and doing these things. Number one, you know, the idea of catching terrorists, so-called terrorists. Then they had the other one, which is democracy. You know, they've got to, they're out in the world to spread democracy and human rights. These are just three of the lines that they, use as a way of pushing their armies in. And of course, it's an industrial military complex, which one has to ask a serious question. Who's actually in control of this industrial military arms complex? Is it the Defense Secretary of America? Is it the Senate? Is it the President of America? Because quite frankly, who's going to take responsibility for all these millions of deaths which this industrial military complex has perpetrated across that region? Because there are millions. Once you count Iraq, you count Libya, you count Yemen, you count the Afghan region, the wars on Iran, let's not forget, all of these were initiated by that same machine. So, you know, what is the world going to do about that machinery, that industrial military complex, and who actually finances, powers, and manages it? There are a lot of course, questions about the money mafias and those who have corporate interests also using these military machines in order to sell all of their their sort of weapons, you know, Raytheon and all the other kind of Boeing and various, you know, Lockheed Martin, all those who profiteered out of the lives that have been lost are also culpable. You know, there are a lot of criminals that need to be rounded up and taken to account. But of course, Western Electra don't know much, nor do they care very much about their foreign policies. They complain about immigrants, you know, Afghan immigrants when they started coming back here. But actually, if they stop invading other countries, pay more attention to their psychopathic leaders who they vote in, who then go on these war expeditions for their own corporate buddies' interests and their own financial interests, it may mean that even the West would suffer less from terrorism, suffer less from migrant crises, which they're now moaning and complaining about. They would have less anti-terror laws passed, which have been applied in perpetuity by all of these U.S. coalition nations, you know, which changed society here in the West forever. In fact, the march towards capitalist totalitarianism is inexorable, along with COVID. But the wars of terror are actually what initiated those. You know, Islamophobia has gone through the roof in the West. You know, thousands of the coalition troops themselves have been maimed or killed. Those families, all in vain, have lost lives, lost people. So the damage and who actually is going to be, if you like, held culpable is the real shame of it, because right. Nobody will be, because there is no international body that can actually bring the war criminals like Bush, like Tony Blair, those who've been on these kind of crusades in the Muslim lands. Nobody's bringing them to task. They're running around free.
Right. Well, Richard Becker, if you want to take purely at the numbers here, we know that the U.S. has spent quite a bit of money in this country, not to mention the coalition forces from other countries. If we were to come out with some figures, I'm sure it would be a large figure. You would figure in 20 years' time, if that money was spent in the presence of U.S. forces and other countries' forces for the infrastructure of Afghanistan, that the country would be doing better, a country that's supposedly resource-rich. Kind of mirrors what has happened in Iraq. And it leads one to think, perhaps, that there wasn't really that much of a motivation for the U.S. to make sure that the country was built, its infrastructure, to have advanced. We know it has done some projects. Why wasn't the focus put more on that to at least see Afghanistan prosper, Afghan people prosper that way?
Well, clearly that is not in the interest, that's not what interests the leaders in the United States, both the politicians on the national level and the military politicians, the civilian politicians and the military politicians. What their real aim is global domination. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but the cost that is paid by the people of Afghanistan, the people of the world, by this immense waste of resources. I mean, it's unbelievable. The real military budget of the United States this year, they'll say it's $715 billion, but it won't be. It'll be really $1.2 trillion or something like that to pay for past wars and present wars. And this goes on year after year after year. If we look at what has been spent, you know, in just the last 20 years on wars, the wars in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, but the other wars are against Libya, Yemen, but the military budget as a whole. And it's a place where these military industrial corporations that your other guest is referring to, they feast on it. They grow richer and richer and richer, but the people pay for it. You know, we just lost a great humanitarian figure opposed to imperialism and domination, Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General. And I traveled with him often into other countries to speak, for him to speak, and he was always emphasizing this point, that this was a crime against the people. And he would quote Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. That's even more true today than it was then.
Well, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking through some of the quotes that Biden has made on this day, coming into the speech that he's made regarding the withdrawal. And another one stands out from what he has said, and that is what he referred to as terrorism, and let me make sure that I quote him accurately, that he will, Biden says that he will, the U.S. will continue to work to prevent the re-emergence of terrorism. You would think 20 years would be enough, and it can't even provide, it can't even do that for its own country. How could Biden even make a claim to that effect when it has failed, not only in this country, Afghanistan, but also, for example, in Iraq?
Well, the claim is obviously, sorry, I'm just going to have to back up, I think, a little bit. Yeah, my battery, sorry. Yeah, your question is obviously, first of all, I have to say how ludicrous the statement Biden made is. The bottom line is that America, you know, has now got a reputation worldwide, and it's renowned for that reputation of torture, and it's lost its credibility as a defender of justice. It's lost its credibility as a sort of a purveyor of human rights. The UK also comes in second place as a complicit sideshow to that. You know, the crowning achievement of this war of terror on the Afghani people is that now the Taliban, who they fought, are going to oust anybody that the Americans want, okay. and their points for a return to power. So the legacy of war and terror in the invasion of Afghanistan should never be forgotten. It can be summed up by saying it's probably the most destructive, single biggest failure of the 21st century, certain for the Americans.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank our guests. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time. Richard Becker spoke to us from San Francisco, from the Answer Coalition, and you were just listening to Sima Sinha Bass, journalist and political commentator there from London. Thank you for your contribution. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale and the entire team in the Capitol, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.